Hey, 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 this is Al Letson. You're listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT. I'm coming to you live from Studio 2, sitting in the big chair. And today, why health officials in the U.S. want to ease restrictions on marijuana and the impact of medication shortages. Plus, a closer look at the First Coast Relief Fund and how you can help. But first, marijuana is currently listed as a Schedule 1 drug alongside substances such as heroin and LSD. Last week, the Department of Health and Human Services asked the Drug Enforcement Agency to reconsider marijuana's classification in an attempt to ease restrictions. Sally Kent Peebles, a cannabis attorney and partner at the Vicente Sedenberg LLP, is here for a closer look at the issue. Sally, how you doing?
Doing great. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming in. So let's dive in and talk a little bit about marijuana. But before we do, you, dear listener, can join the conversation. You can call us at 549-2937. You can tweet us at FCC on air. Email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org or message us on the First Coast Connect Facebook page. So, Sally, how long have you been advocating for marijuana?
I switched out of oil and gas back in 2014 and went from black oil over to green oil and joined Vicente LLP. It's a national law firm. And we do a lot of advocacy work. We write the laws that a lot of states and local governments rely on. And we also support businesses.
So just to get sort of like the ground floor and understanding, like right now, marijuana is considered a Class A, is it? Or
it's Schedule 1 Schedule under the 1, Controlled Substances Act. And that is reserved for substances that have no medical use, a high potential for abuse, and no accepted safety standards, even under medical supervision. So this is really reserved for the most dangerous drugs, like you said, heroin. And marijuana is in there, too, as well as psilocybin.
Just random question. When you say that, the first thing that comes to mind is, does that mean that, like, say, a drug like OxyContin is not in the Schedule 1?
It is not. That is a Schedule 2 drug with prescription of opioids like fentanyl, as well as cocaine is actually Schedule 2 because it does have a recognized medical use.
Wow. So you're saying, like, basically we're in an opioid epidemic right now, and fentanyl and drugs like OxyContin are like leading the wave of it, and they are not a Schedule 1, but marijuana is.
Yes, your surprise and shock is what a lot of advocates deal with on a daily basis. The way that things are scheduled with Schedule 2 through 5, it really the drugs become less dangerous. And this recent HHS official recommendation to the DEA is that it goes from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3. And that would place it next to drugs such as ketamine, anabolic steroids, and testosterone. All of those which notably do have a higher potential of abuse than marijuana. And, you know, the fact that marijuana is a Schedule 1 drug today has really created a lot of issues for the industry. It has been a primary obstacle to research. It really pits the federal government against the state. So they've created this two-tiered system where marijuana companies that operate in the U.S. Are violating federal law every day on one hand, yet trying their best to be compliant with the laws of the states. And of course, as we've discussed on this show several times, it creates a lot of tax issues and banking problems for these businesses. So what would this Schedule 3 really do? You know, what does this mean for state businesses? I've been asked this all week. Is this going to change enforcement? You know, are we no longer breaking federal law? Unfortunately, no. Enforcement's not going to change much. We are still... The cannabis businesses that are operating in Florida today are breaking federal law. And if it goes from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3, they will still be breaking federal law.
So when you say they are breaking federal law, it's because we in the state have decided that it's okay to use or to sell as long as you have a card. And places like California and Colorado, the state has said, okay. It's okay to use these drugs recreationally.
Well,
but it's still a federal.
Yeah, it's still a federal law. These businesses are operating in violation of federal law because it is listed on the Controlled Substances Act. In Florida, the state of Florida and many other states in the United States, 38 for medical and 23 for adult use, they took the initiative to place the question in front of the voters. So it wasn't just the state saying that they should have medical marijuana in the state of Florida. The voters of Florida came out and cast their ballot in support of having medical marijuana be available to patients with a doctor recommendation.
Mm-hmm. So I have a little bit more clarification. When I think about, like, so I've been living in California for the last 5 years, and I'm not. I am such a lightweight, like literally if I go to the bar, two drinks, I'm good. The idea of marijuana in me, not so much, but, you know, I go to the gym a lot and sometimes I may, you know, tweak a muscle or something. And in California, I have a topical ointment that has THC in it. And, that ointment, like, it's a miracle. Like, I use it and the next day, whatever the issue was, like, it has gone away. So for me, like, the idea that marijuana doesn't have medicinal purposes, and that's part of the reason why it's a Schedule I, it doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense.
It doesn't make sense, and that's why this is so huge, because it is this is the country's top health agency finally acknowledging that cannabis has medical value. And of course, like you point out, 38 states have already acknowledged that there is medical value.
Including Florida.
And the position I'm in, my day-to-day, I am approached by people on the street. I'm approached by clients. I'm approached by several phone calls, emails, people telling me how medical marijuana has helped their life, their day-to-day, whether it be through sleep or maybe their children have Dravet syndrome. It's been a lifesaver for a lot of cancer patients. There have been studies to show that it shrinks tumors in lab animals, and it definitely helps with being able to eat when you're going through chemotherapy. It helps ease that nausea.
I have a loved one who had terminal cancer, and the only way to get his appetite going up was at cannabis.
Yeah, it helps the quality of life.
I should say that he liked cannabis before he had before the cancer treatments. But yes, like, it absolutely helped his appetite.
It absolutely can. And this Schedule I to Schedule III is really going to be welcome news by these businesses, because it's going to ease 280E. Because 280E is a tax code that says these businesses cannot take tax deductions. So these businesses, even though people think they're making money hand over fist, they're being taxed at anywhere between 70 to 85%. So it's something to consider now that is going to be removed.
And we've got some comments. One, John is on Facebook. Even if a person were against recreational use, I think it would be logical to place marijuana on the proper schedule based on agreed information. I can't believe it's still Schedule I. And then Junior from Twitter says, is the Attorney General's latest attempt to prevent marijuana legalization in Florida getting on the 2024 ballot going in her favor? I read that the company behind the ballot initiative is confident that the measure will make it to the ballot after the last failed attempt.
Yes. So there is a group called Smart and Safe Florida that has put together a well-written, strong initiative to legalize the use of marijuana for adult use for those 21 and over in the state of Florida. As part of that process to make it to the ballot, they have to get Supreme Court approval of the language. Ashley Moody, our attorney general, has written, is very opposed, as she was back in 2021. Her opposition and her arguments actually held the day back in 2021 twice. They shot down two different adult use initiatives back then. I'm hoping that she is not successful this time around. Her argument is that the ballot summary, which is what you actually read on the ballot, not the language in the initiative itself, but the summary, she is saying that is misleading to those that will be casting their ballot that day, similar to her arguments back in 2021. And Trulieve put around $39 million of their own dollars to get this passed.
You can join the conversation at 549-2937. You can tweet us at FCC On Air, First Coast Connect at WJCT.org, and you can find us on Facebook. And we're going to go to the phones. We've got Mark on the south side. Mark, how are you this morning?
I'm living the dream. I hope y'all are.
All right. What you got for me, Mark?
Yeah, I have a question. If and when it goes from a Schedule 1 to a Schedule 4, and you were talking about the medicinal use of marijuana, I have no doubt there are some good medicinal uses for marijuana, but currently it almost seems, and I hate to use this word, like snake oil. Every time you turn around, oh, take a gummy, do this, do that. I mean, it cures everything from toenail fungus to balding heads to prostate cancer. If it goes to Schedule 4, are there any restrictions, if you will, on the promotion of marijuana for these medicinal uses? I mean, is there going to be a time where if they're going to be marketed as a supplement to help with something, that they would have to undergo rigorous clinical trials in order to prove their efficacy in treating various things?
Hey, Mark, I'm going to let Sally answer that question, but after that, I have a question for you. Can you hang on the line while Sally answers? Sally, go ahead.
Sure.
Okay, so first of all, it's actually being recommended to go to Schedule 3, not Schedule 4. Schedule 4 is reserved for drugs like Xanax, while Schedule 3 has ketamine, testosterone, anabolic steroids. Your question is really talking about the medical claims that are made by these companies. If you go into a medical marijuana dispensary where these products are regulated, you will not see those claims made because they're not permitted to do so. The FDA, that has regulatory oversight over all drugs, including whether or not you're on Schedule 1, so it doesn't matter what schedule you're on, they are going after companies that make false medical claims. So you can rest assured it's being worked on. However, the FDA doesn't have a ton of money at its disposal to do all this. But there are strict advertising rules in place to ensure that people are not misled. But what we really need is more research on these products to find out what does work and for what. And the good news is moving it from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3 will really remove barriers that are put in place right now that deny research to be done in the United States, so we can finally obtain that long-awaited granular data needed to help patients and make sure that the claims being made are accurate.
Did okay. That answer your question, Mark?
It did, especially the last part about being more accessible to clinical trials. I'm in the pharmaceutical business, and so I understand what's involved in getting a product to market and the rigorous clinical trials that products generally have to undergo in order to be able to make certain claims. And it baffles me when I see, you know, all the cannabis shops that are popping up, and everybody thinks they're going in there. And again, I have no doubt there probably is some, you know, legit medicinal use for it. But with all the claims that are out there, I think people are
yeah, we should get to the bottom.
They don't know how much they're supposed to take, and you know, they may be doing something wrong. And maybe if they took one more gummy, then it would fix it. But in the absence of clinical data, you just don't know as a consumer.
And go ahead.
Agreed. And to make that distinction, the cannabis, marijuana in Florida is sold out of dispensaries that are regulated by the state. When you're talking about these cannabis products popping up in smoke shops, those are actually unregulated by the Department of Health, and they're under the Department of Ag and follow under the hemp laws. So it's slightly different, and they're held to different standards. And the FDA is actively going after hemp companies that are talking about the different cannabinoids and what sort of health claims they have. They just simply don't have the budget to go after everything, but they are doing their best.
Mark, my question to you was that your question was based in like medical and like the medical information. Are you opposed to, and there's no wrong answer, I'm just curious, are you opposed to recreational marijuana?
Oh, no. I mean, I find it kind of ironic that, you know, every street corner has a liquor store in it, and you can go there and buy all the booze that you want to. And if people want to sit at home and get high, I don't care. Knock yourself out. That's fine with me. You know, if you go back in time, you used to get DWIs, drinking while intoxicated. Now it's DUI, drinking under the influence. So, you know, if you get stoned and you get in a car and cause injury to someone else, and you can get a DUI, I would think. And I have no problem with that kind of holding somebody responsible for their actions if they are under the influence of some product. But the libertarian in me says, hey, go ahead. I don't have a problem with it.
Mark, thanks so much for your answer. That was I'm just curious about like where people stand on this. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Have a good day. And we've got Charlie in Jack's Beach. Charlie, how you doing this morning?
I'm doing great. Just one quick question for you. I'm a gym junkie. I understand you're a gym junkie.
I would say so, yes.
Yes, sir. Any kind of specialty? I'm a mixed martial artist, boxer.
No, I just like to work out. Although I am going to start my game plan long term is to start some martial arts. But yeah, no, I just like to lift.
All right. So my question for your guest is, how does this affect? And just let me qualify this by saying I don't put nothing in my body, marijuana, nothing, nada. But I don't have a problem with recreational use of marijuana. How does this affect drug-free workplaces, testing, et cetera, and driving an automobile test time? That's my question. Thank you.
Thank you, Charlie.
So this recommendation from the Health and Human Services to the DEA will have no effect on that. As of today, it is illegal to consume marijuana and drive, just it is illegal to consume alcohol over a certain level and drive. And so really, I would say the impetus should be on education and making sure people know how to consume responsibly. But last week's recommendation from the HHS to DEA will have no effect on those types of issues. And you mentioned employment as well. So employers are not we don't meddle with employers' rights to instill their own drug-free laws and policies. Employer can go after an employee for drinking too much, and they can go after an employee for smoking too much marijuana or doing so on the job. They can also choose to turn a blind eye to that. That's really up to the companies themselves, and the state does not mandate that employers treat cannabis users in a different way.
You said something earlier about taxes and how this is taxed at these dispensaries. Can you clear it up for me? Because my understanding, places like Colorado and California, the dispensaries, when I went in to buy the ointment, I've also just to be honest, I don't want to be hiding anything. I've like bought the ointment for muscles or for topical stuff, but also I suffer from insomnia, so I've tried gummies. They do not work for me. I have a very bad reaction to them because I'm such a lightweight. But whenever I've gotten those, the prices that what you're paying for in California, it's pretty expensive. It's not a cheap buy. And when I was talking to the people at the dispensary, they were like, "Well, it's taxes. Like you're being taxed a lot." So I guess the question I have for you is, it seems like states are making a lot of money from taxing these things. Will that change with this schedule, with changing the schedule? Like, how does that work?
No, this has nothing to do with sales tax, which is what you're referring to. So a lot of states add an extra penalty tax, you can call it, an excise tax, and that's generally on adult use marijuana, which is what you would have been exposed to in Colorado, because mm-hmm. I imagine you don't have a patient card.
No.
So you couldn't have bought a medical. But so you went in and bought adult use marijuana, legalized marijuana, and that is usually has a heavier tax, sales tax, that is pushed over to the consumer.
Gosh, when you say it like that, I feel my mom might be listening. Mom, I don't smoke. I don't smoke. It's just ointment. It's like,
But any sort of adult use, any sort of cannabis that's being sold for those 21 and over without a prescription would be referred to as adult use marijuana. And that is taxed, a sales tax, an extra sales tax is added in most states. We don't have that in Florida. There is no extra tax on medical marijuana in the state of Florida. If we were to legalize it, I imagine that we would, and we would get the great tax benefit. What I was referring to earlier is a federal tax code called 280E that does not allow anyone who is trafficking a Schedule 1 or Schedule 2 substance to take regular business deductions, just like when you're filing your taxes.
And we're going to go to the phone. We've got Michael. Michael, how are you doing this morning?
Good morning, sir. I feel like I should be humming the tune to the Twilight Zone as I listen to this discussion, it's really extraordinary that more than a half century during which Americans have had access to marijuana without a great deal of effort, we're still having a discussion about whether or not a big daddy is going to be able to control what we do. So that's my comment, and thank you for having the discussion.
Michael, thank you so much. Yeah, I think, you know, drug policy in the United States has always been tied to, I mean, you know, if we're being honest, it's always been tied to race. And when it came to marijuana, the initial users of marijuana tended to be migrants, usually from Mexico. And they were the watching Latino men and women smoke became another way to restrict their, you know, to lock them up, to take away their freedom. And that law gets codified and pushed throughout the whole United States. And then you see what we have today when we see a lot of people of color doing big time sentences in prison over these laws that were created primarily because it was targeting somebody based on their race.
Yes, I think we could have a whole whole program on that topic. And you are right. The caller said 50 years. We have been dealing with this for 50 years. And, you know, I've been asked this a lot this week. The DEA is now being told that they should reschedule from 1 to 3. Well, do they have to listen? They certainly don't. And in fact, back in 1988, the DEA's own chief administrative law judge said that marijuana is the safest therapeutically active substance that's known to man. That was their own hired judge, and the DEA did not listen to his advice. So they could do the same thing here. I hope they don't. And historically, they've always seen these recommendations as binding. So hopefully they do so here.
And we're going to go to the phones. We've got Daryl in St. Augustine. Daryl, how are you, sir?
Hey, great. Good morning, Al. I've been a proponent for the legalization of marijuana pretty much my entire adult life. But as an employer, I do have a question. Can I deny someone taking their medicine, which is the way they have it in Florida right now? I can tell an employee, you can't come to work drinking. I'm not sure I can tell an employee that he can't come here and not take his medicine because he's been prescribed that medicine.
Thanks.
Yes.
I don't want them high and I don't want them drunk, but I don't care if they get high or drunk at home.
Yeah, thanks, Daryl.
So the medical marijuana law in Florida does not change your ability as an employer to enforce your own drug policies within your company.
All right. And that's all the time we have for this today. Sally Kent Peebles, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us about this.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll be right back. And we are back. You're listening to First Coast Connect. I'm Al Letson, sitting in the big chair in Studio 2 at WJCT. How you doing today? I know it feels like a Tuesday, but it's actually hump day. It's Wednesday. That is pretty amazing. It means that we're closer to the weekend. Beautiful things. So we started off talking about one drug. Now we're moving over to talk about another drug. You see, the U.S. is experiencing an uptick in drug shortages. Some of these medications are vital to patient health, including antibiotics and life-saving cancer treatments. What is the FDA doing to resolve the issue, and should elected officials get involved? On the line with me is Dr. Joe Servin, neurologist at Mayo Clinic and our in-house medical expert to talk it through. Dr. Joe, how you doing?
Hey, Al, how are you doing?
I am good. Every time I hear your voice, I smile. It's always good to hear from you.
Same here, Al.
So, what are some of the most significant medications that are scarce or unavailable?
Oh, Al, if it was only one, it would be much easier to report. But the reality is there's several, and they cross different classes. It started out post-pandemic with this shortage of Adderall, which is used for attention deficit disorder. Then more recently, it's been a very specific chemo agent used for cancer management called carboplatin. And then there's been shortages of amoxicillin, that's super common antibiotic. And there have been, with no surprise, shortages of can't keep it on the shelves drug Ozempic and Wegovy, like these weight loss agents that have come out. So they straddle lots of different areas. And as always, the answer to what's causing it is very nuanced.
Yeah. When you said amoxicillin, I thought, amoxicillin, my old friend from having little kids, right? Like ear infections.
Ear infections, exactly.
Amoxicillin, like I know that one very well. But when you bring up stuff like Ozempic I can't think of the name, the medication that people use for ADHD.
Adderall.
Ozempic and Adderall, like, I think about both of those drugs as people using them for maybe not what they were intended to use for. Is that part of why we're having a shortage on those drugs?
It's not. I mean, there's always a little bit of that, but there's actually the bigger issue is just it all is about demand. The issue with Ozempic and Adderall is demand. Now, post-pandemic, in the story of attention deficit, when teleneurology became super common because no one could see their doctors in person because of COVID, the diagnosis of ADHD went up fairly dramatically. Now, it's unclear whether is it because people had more access to doctors through telemedicine or is that a correct diagnosis? But the demand for that drug went through the roof. And for those people who have ADHD, they'll tell you they can't function without it. The Ozempic story, well, that drug came out more for diabetes, but when they found the indication for weight loss, as our show, as your show has covered a lot, that they just can't keep around because of just how popular that drug has become. And that demand, they can't keep track of that. Now, the story of an amoxicillin or the cancer drugs, those are mostly generic drugs, and those have to do with the fact that it isn't that there's a huge demand. There's always a huge demand, but it has to do more with the fact that the manufacturer facilities where they make these drugs, either something has broken down, something hasn't happened. A lot of generic drugs, they are made off U.S. shores now. And as a result, if anything happens, it could be from a hurricane to some issue that occurs in that area locally, that can disrupt production. And that leads to very real consequences for us over here on U.S. soil.
Yeah. And now is the shortages, are they affecting the price of these medications?
Well, for the brand medications, the answer is yes. For generics, it's always hard. Generics are supposed to be cheaper, but when you can't find it, the price immediately goes up. And there aren't a lot for some of these drugs, particularly the generic ones. The profit margin, and I hate talking about that, but the profit margin for them are so low that something like this, where there's a huge demand and a small amount, that's going to jack up the price of a generic drug, which has probably been around for years and years and years. And you're like saying, how did this happen? And it's simply supply and demand in that particular instance.
It feels like this whole story is kind of really outlining the fact that we have a huge problem in the United States when it comes to pharmaceuticals, not just in price, but in availability. And I just remember when COVID first started, I was talking to a scientist and they were basically telling me that the profit margin for vaccines is like so small that we tend to not like, or pharmaceutical companies tend to not do a lot of research on vaccines because they just can't make a whole lot of money doing it. So I guess what that tells me is that like there are bigger systemic problems in the pharmaceutical industry. And what we're talking about is sort of points to that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. If as one expert has said about the American pharmaceutical industry, it's really a tale of two worlds. There is the innovation side where everyone says, gee whiz, there's a medication for that. That's dramatic. It's branded. It's new. It's exciting. And it really shows the innovation of or the potential of innovation for medicine. Those branded drugs, they're out there and it can be very dramatic and they claim a lot of price because those branded drugs are expensive. Then there's the other world, the generic drugs, once they're off patent. There, from vaccines to antibiotics to anything along those lines, the profit margins become smaller because it's not just one company that's making a lot of money off of that. There are now multiple companies making that. And if something goes wrong, here's where we find ourselves. So there is issues, particularly in that generic market, when it's critical that, you know, here we find ourselves with a situation like this, that something has to be done. And yeah, there's not a lot of money going in that direction or regulation for that matter.
Are there any significant tolls on patients, on their outcomes when they can't get these medications?
For some of the cancer drugs, you're talking about a life-saving medication. So that could be fairly serious. Now, the nice thing is that doctors will try to deal, and other providers will try to deal with this by finding other medications that may work, but not everything is that simple to substitute. Many a patient will tell you that a specific drug, when they try to go to a generic or something else, it's just not the same. We don't know what happens in that, but just by following logic, there probably would have to be some poor outcome in some way, shape, or form when we switch these things out, especially if it's been working well for a patient. I hate the idea of if someone switched my meds on me in the middle of everything going well, I'd be a little bit nervous about that, or yeah, maybe a lot more nervous about that.
Is there any insight to this crisis, or is this going to be a long-term issue that we just have to learn how to deal with?
This is going to have to be a long-term issue. See, the FDA has a rule for that companies have to alert them when there's a shortage, but they don't have to alert them if there's a sudden run-up on demand. So a simple little fix like that, just a rule fix, could be helpful, but that's one thing that could be easily done. The larger scheme of things, that's going to be something that we're going to have to manage. And there are some things that we can do to try to manage it just on a day-to-day basis.
Dr. Joe Servin, a neurologist at Mayo Clinic and our in-house medical expert, thank you so much for coming on.
Al, it's always a pleasure.
All right, and we'll be right back. Hey, you're listening to First Coast Connect. I'm Al Letson, and that music was brought to you by David Luckin. I love that song, David. Like, you got to give that to me. It's great. You are listening to First Coast Connect. I'm sitting in the big chair in Studio 2, and in a serious topic, the Jacksonville community is reeling from the deaths of three residents that lost their lives as a result of anti-Black racism. And a significant part of the healing process involves in addressing racial inequities in the community. First Coast Relief Fund aims to do just that. Melanie Patz, President and CEO of United Way, is here with more details. Melanie, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so tell me exactly what the Relief Fund is.
So the First Coast Relief Fund was initially conceived as a result of the Pulse nightclub shootings in Orlando. And our community wanted to have a collaborative, proactive response to tragedies. Unfortunately, the shooting, the racial terror shooting that occurred, is the first time that we've acted the fund for a man-made disaster.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to that, it has been hurricanes and COVID. And we've distributed more than $9 million to nonprofits helping people to recover from those disasters.
What organizations are involved?
As I mentioned before, it's collaborative. So mm-hmm. it is United Way of Northeast Florida, United Way of St. John's County, which also includes Putnam,
mm-hmm.
The Community Foundation for Northeast Florida, the Jewish Federation and Foundation, and joining us for this initiative is the Together Strong Community Fund.
So can you tell me exactly how the fund is addressing what happened a couple weeks ago?
So at this point, we are collecting resources, and Dollar General has announced some funding for the fund. Bank of America and Regency Centers have also announced support in addition to the Together Strong Community Fund. So as I mentioned before, this is the first activation of a man-made disaster. And we activated it quickly because people were raising their hands saying, what can we do? We need to do something to help. It is not a fund for victims or survivors because those funds had already been established and there's no wrong way to give, and we didn't want to compete with those funds that had been established. So what we're doing is identifying people to help us determine medium and long-term strategies to address racial inequities in our community. And so that could include things like capacity building for nonprofit organizations, education about race and racism, as well as grief counseling for this particular incident.
Mm-hmm. When you say that, the question that comes to mind for me, and this may be a question that you can't answer because it's a tough one, but to me, it seems like this nation is so fractured.
Yeah.
And the shooter that carried off this this racist massacre, he's where the work has to go. Like he's you know, it's not like when I think about the people who lost their lives, you know, I'm heartbroken for them. But really, like the where the change has to come from is the person who had the gun. And so I guess the question I have is, how do we address that? Maybe not just as your organization, but as a nation. Like, how do we address that? Because, you know, we can, I heard this quote once that has always stuck with me. And that is that, like, I think what this country tends to do is it tends to treat young Black people like they're trying to teach them how to be a better Trayvon Martin instead of looking at society and trying to teach them how not to be a George Zimmerman.
Sure.
And yeah. So like, that's the question, right? Like, how do we change the conversation and stop looking at Black folks and expecting them to be a better Trayvon Martin and target the Zimmermans of this country?
That's a great question. And so one thing that I'll say is the First Coast Relief Fund is First Coast. It is not Jacksonville or Duval. And we talked about that when we decided to activate it that for this man-made disaster, for the racial terror shootings, because, as you know, the shooter came from another county. Mm-hmm. And so this is a regional issue that we need to address. So to answer your question, I love research. And the only research that I've read that has shown measurable change in people's hearts and minds and behavior is getting proximate, getting connected to people who are different than they are. And so until we realize that my success is dependent upon your success, mm-hmm. and your success is dependent upon my success, we are not going to make the change that we want in this world. The hope that I see is there are people all over this community and in this country who recognize that they have biases, that they are racist, and they want to make change in their lives and in their attitudes. So we've got to harness that. And I've said before, we have got to create a better party, a party where people want to come in and say, hey, I want to be united. I want to be part of this collective group where we're all supporting each other. And that's the only way that we're going to make the change that we want to see that's lasting.
Yeah, because I think that, you know, when I think about the community of Northwest Jacksonville, you just have people who are like working hard to just, you know, because to get by in this world is a lot, right? Yep. So you've got people that are working hard, and then this guy comes from outside of the community with hate in his heart and you know, commits acts of violence. And it's so hard when, like, you know, I don't believe in the theory of like a lone wolf, because I think that mm-hmm. these lone wolves, like, there is a foundation and a connection. Somebody, you may learn hatred at home, but also, like, I just feel like picking up that gun and going to do something like that, like, it's there's something bigger going on there that's pushing people towards it. I don't know how to address that. I don't know how to, like, take that bigger thing down. But I do believe what you're saying about the research. Like, that makes absolute sense to me.
Yeah. So I think racism and hatred both are learned at home, and they're learned in society, and they're cultivated in society. So you were talking about, how do we change the world so that we're not the Zimmermans of the world? It is about crafting the environment. And so when I say we got to throw a better party, that means we've got to create a situation where people realize it's better over here than it is over there.
Yeah. How can folks get involved to help?
Great. Thank you for that. So they can text Healing Jacks to 50503, or they can Google the First Coast Relief Fund.
Yeah. And give me that number one more time.
Yeah. It's Healing Jacks to 50503.
Melanie Patz is the president and CEO of United Way. Thank you so much for coming down to talk to us.
Thank you for the invitation.
Congarean Pen, dedicated to agriculture and culinary endeavors, offering field-to-fork dining and outdoor experiences on over 300 acres. Sip, dine, explore. Information at congareeandpen.com. Baptist Health is a proud supporter of First Coast Connect. Baptist Health, committed to building a healthier community for all of us. More info at 202-4YOU or baptistjacks.com.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Personal Injury and Wrongful Death Law Firm. When people are hurt through no fault of their own, answering who, what, when, where, why, and how is critical to proving the truth. More at TerrellHogan.com.
Hi, I'm David Luckin. Join me Saturday nights at 10 for This Week in Music History, a journey into the music, news, and pop culture of yesterday and today. This Week in Music History, only on WJCT News 89.9, 10 p.m. Saturday nights.
Muslims from around the globe are on a pilgrimage heading to the Iraqi city of Karbala.
We have never seen selflessness of this kind anywhere, and it is an inspiration to see this.
When I did my first walk, it was very emotional.
They're paying homage to the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. That's next time on The World.
This afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
Author Chuck Palahniuk's books inhabit the dark, unsavory places most of us choose to avoid. The man behind Fight Club has published 26 books and built a global fan base for his taboo-busting storytelling. His latest book takes on a murderous aristocratic family in the Welsh countryside. We talk to Chuck Palahniuk next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
All right, you're listening to First Coast Connect. This is Al Letson sitting in the big chair in Studio 2 at WJCT. Duval, it's first Wednesday of the month, which means Art Walk is happening downtown tonight. Whether you are soul searching or looking to kick it, our next guest has something for you. Okay, so like I did not write those puns. Candace,
I like them.
You like them, but I didn't write them. I didn't write them. I'm just saying puns are not my thing. But with me is my friend Candace Nicole, founder of the Black Mural Map and Petite Art Pop-Up. So can you tell us about why they put these puns in my script? The Bless Your Soul. Where did that idea come from?
So the Petite series is actually a series of art shows that I base all of the shows off of things that bring us joy or nostalgia. And so Bless Your Soul is a shoe about sneaker culture.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Nice. So tell me about some of the shoes that people will see down there.
So we have some commissioned shoes. I personally commissioned 6 artists to do shoes. And so we have everything from deconstructed shoes to shoes that are just painted. And then we also have paintings and also some amazing sculptures, even a lamp.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so can people buy these shoes or are they just for display?
Absolutely. If the artist has it for sale, then it's for sale.
And exactly what you do is like placemaking, right? Like you go to a place and create art there. Can you tell us a little bit more for our audience who may not understand exactly what that is?
Okay, so the current space that I'm using is right next to Sweet Pete's, and the building itself is an unused space. And so we activate the courtyard, and then we have the inside. When we first got it, you know, it had its problems. It still has its problems, but we fix it up. We make it amazing, and then we have a gallery. And I always separate the gallery from the outside space because I think it's very important for the art to be a focus when you're in that space.
Mm-hmm.
But we want to have fun too, so we have an activation outside as well.
Nice. And how did you get into doing this? I guess the word that comes to mind is like art entrepreneur. Like you taking the art out and you're giving it to the community, or you're selling it to the community. Like it's an amazing thing. Like how'd you get on this road?
So honestly, I have grown up, I guess, kind of like in the art world as far as going to art school and things like that. And I've always loved art, but I will be honest and say that my husband being an artist also was a big push.
Mm-hmm.
And I personally cannot draw. I'm very creative. And so it just made sense for me to go on this path because I went to a lot of art shows and I would end up helping.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, well, I can do this myself because I have amazing concepts that I want to bring to life. And so that's kind of like how this became to be.
Yeah. And so how long have you been doing this?
Since, let's see, I would say 2016. I've actually had a show here in WJCT too.
So. Yeah. Who are the artists that are participating in Bless Your Soul?
Ooh, Ooh, it's a lot of them.
Just okay. Give me a couple. Like, hey, don't get mad if she didn't say your name.
Oh, yeah. Don't get mad. So I'll start with some of the...
Is your husband doing it?
Yes. Chris Clark has one shoot in the show.
You see how I helped you out there?
Okay.
Because you would have gotten in trouble.
No, I wouldn't have gotten in trouble. Okay. He got it down.
He's like, I don't care.
But... one of the biggest things that you'll see at the show is actually a Bless Your Soul mural.
Okay.
And it is by Johnny Worms. That's his artist name is Worms. He has a mural there. And then we have Grace Bio, Elaine Olander, Tatiana Kitchen, Jared Walker. There's lots of artists. We have an amazing artist from Miami who deconstructed the Air Force One. His name is Nathaniel Marrero. He goes by Coest Sneakers. We have Mir Mason. She made a lamp. There are a lot of artists, so nobody beat me up. And then we have amazing sculptures. So I was really excited to find this artist. His name is Gerald Lilliard, and he has four sculptures of sneakers, one of a Jordan, one of an Air Force. He has a concept shoe and another that mirrors the Bless Your Soul flyer.
So how can people see this exhibit at Artwork tonight?
So we are right next to Sweet Pete's at 424 North Hogan Street. You cannot miss us. We'll have the courtyard activated with a band called Universal Green. And then when you walk straight through the courtyard, you'll see a big Bless Your Soul sign. And that's where the gallery is.
Candace Nicole, founder of the Black Mural Map and Petite Art Pop-Up. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much.
All right. And ladies and gentlemen, that is our program. Thanks to all our guests and callers. Our executive producer is music maestro David Luckin. Our associate producer is Stacey the Brain Bennett. Our director, the Steven Spielberg of the operation, is Brady Corum. The music was performed by Club De Belugas. If you have questions or comments about First Coast Connect, send an email to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. I'm Al Letson. You've been listening to the show here on WJCT News 89.9. And remember, y'all, keep your heart open for Duval and each other. And I will talk to you tomorrow.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.